were lost in vain. After the attack on Tripoli, we didn't hear much more from Gaddafi's terrorists. But back in the U.S., Reagan had a different battle to fight with the Democrats, and leading the charge was none other than John Kerry. Quote, while I stated my initial inclination was to support the president, Kerry wrote, I pointed out that two essential tests had to be met in determining whether or not the U.S. action was appropriate. First, the United States had to have irrefutable evidence directly linking the Gaddafi regime to a terrorist act. And second, our response should be proportional to the act. The evidence was irrefutable that the Gaddafi regime was behind the Berlin disco bombing, which claimed the lives of two innocent victims and injured 200 others. Quote, however, as to the second test, it is obvious that our response was not proportional to the disco bombing and even violated that administration's own guidelines to hit clearly defined terrorist targets, thereby minimizing the risk to innocent civilians. I believe it was a mistake for us to select as targets areas of heavy civilian concentrations, as well as to include the family and home of the head of state of another country, no matter how repugnant we find the leader. The fact that the bombing resulted in the deaths of at least 17 civilians certainly undermined the administration's own justification for the raid. Beyond this point, however, is the fact that we are not going to solve the problem of terrorism with this kind of retaliation. There are numerous other actions we can take in concert with our allies to bring significant pressure to bear on countries supporting or harboring terrorists. Sure, I wanted to support the president, Kerry was saying, but not if it involved any risks. Better to take numerous other actions in concert with our allies to bring significant pressure to bear. Sound familiar? Sure. Kerry said, I'll vote to support President Bush on the war in Iraq, but not if it involves any political risk to me. And not if it means spending any money. Put me down for yes on the war, no on the funding. Kerry went on to condemn Reagan for calling Gaddafi's bluff over the rights to the Gulf of Sidra. He contended that Gaddafi's claim should have been tested in the world court and then charged that America, supposedly in violation of international law over the mining of Nicaragua's harbors, didn't have the credibility to make the case in the world court. Blame America first, Senator Kerry. Then came his pitch for multilateralism. If only we had conducted our military maneuvers jointly with our NATO alliances, we would have been in a much stronger position to object to Gaddafi's actions. In other words, if America wants to act with credibility, it cannot act alone. There you have it. All the same shameful tactics the senator and his Democratic colleagues are still employing today, appeasing the enemy, blaming America, and insisting on a hollow multilateralism. Needless to say, John Kerry got it exactly wrong, just as he's been profoundly wrong about Iraq today. The use of force by a president is not, in essence, a matter of courage or skill. It's a matter of principles, worldview, and character. Remember, even four-star generals don't ultimately initiate military action. They follow orders. Presidents lead, that is, they're supposed to. Presidents embody executive power. They give orders. They make very lonely decisions when it comes to using America's military might. There is no cover for them, no excuses. Presidential candidates who are not willing to take responsibility shouldn't be willing to take the job. After the Reagan era, things only got worse for the Democrats' credibility. They always seem to be on the wrong side of history. Reagan won the Cold War, no thanks to the Democrats and their freeze-neck friends. Bush won, beat back Saddam, and kept America safe in the early 1990s. Then along came Bill Clinton, who latched onto this double-peace dividend, plus an already rebounding economy. And what does he do? Well, he practically ignores national security for 8 long years. Clinton downgraded and gutted the American military, reducing our Navy to dangerously low levels. Yet at the same time, he expanded our military commitments, but rarely in an effort to protect our national security interests. During the Clinton era, the military came to be used as a kind of glorified Peace Corps. And when Clinton did respond to real assaults against Americans and our strategic interests, he would do so with the proverbial fly swatter. Take his half-hearted swipe at Saddam in 1993. In retaliation for conspiring to assassinate George Herbert Walker Bush in 1993, Clinton sent a few token cruise missiles to Saddam's intelligence headquarters in Baghdad. If anything, as Newsweek pointed out, Saddam was emboldened rather than deterred by this tepid attack, which was followed by two other air attacks against military targets in 1996 and 1998. These days, Clinton seems to be getting a pass for his egregious mishandling of Iraq. During his presidency, though, even some in the mainstream media were calling him to account for it. A full year before President Bush took office, the Boston Globe, by no means a conservative newspaper, wrote a startling editorial describing the mess Clinton had made of the Iraqi situation, a failure that was dangerous not only to the American people, but to the whole world. The Globe labeled Clinton's unwillingness to inspect and dismantle his weapons of mass destruction as, quote, the most flagrant and protracted failure of President Clinton's foreign policy. A few years later, Newsweek described the situation Clinton left behind for his successor, quote, by the time George W. Bush became president in January 2001, Saddam Hussein had every reason to believe that he was winning his long war against the United States. At the United Nations, the French and Russians, eager for oil contracts, were pushing to do away with sanctions altogether. The UN arms inspectors were gone, and no one was agitating very hard to send them back. It's hard to refute this. While we were fooling ourselves into believing we had tamed Hussein during the Clinton years, he was growing ever more sadistic and tyrannical. On February 25, 2003, during one of many eloquent speeches made on the House floor supporting the war, Representative Kurt Weldon of Pennsylvania read into the record a horrific passage from Kenneth Pollack's The Threatening Storm about Saddam's Iraq. Quote, "This is a regime that will gouge out the eyes of children to force confessions from their parents and grandparents. This is a regime that will crush all the bones in the feet of a two-year-old girl to force her mother to divulge her father's whereabouts. This is a regime that will hold a nursing baby at arm's length from its mother and allow the child to starve to death to force the mother to confess. This is a regime that will burn a person's limbs off to force him to confess or comply. A regime that will slowly lower its victims into huge vats of acid, either to break their will or simply as a means of execution." None of this was any secret during Bill Clinton's presidency, to human rights groups or to Clinton himself. In true Democratic tradition, though, he took the path of least resistance, standing by while an endless parade of multilateral and toothless UN resolutions failed to solve the problem for him. Saddam's reign of terror continued throughout Clinton's reign of appeasement. But it wasn't just in Iraq that Clinton fell down on the job. From the first year of his presidency, Clinton telegraphed his attitude and approach toward terrorism around the world. In Somalia, Clinton demonstrated his discomfort with military intervention by sending a limited number of troops into harm's way without proper support, leading to the deaths of 18 troops and the national shame of seeing the charred body of an American soldier dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. Clinton was only comfortable with combat that was politically risk-free, such as his air war against Serbia at 30,000 feet. But Clinton's real distaste for actually countering terrorism, rather than just talking about it, was best illustrated by his non-reaction to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, where six people were murdered and the property damage exceeded $500 million. Clinton refused to see the obvious that this was an act of war. Instead, he acted like the lawyer he was, sending his federal prosecutors out to capture a few of the conspirators and put them on trial while the broader Islamic terror network continued to fester at home and overseas. The fact is, when Clinton and Gore were in a position to actually do something about terrorism, they chose not to. Clinton was too preoccupied with domestic policy and personal scandal to focus on foreign policy. My Fox News colleague, Dick Morris, who worked for the Clintons in the mid-1990s, has written that Clinton, quote, was never able to see terrorism as a threat apart from the normal course of international relations. In Clinton, Morris saw a classic appeaser, always trying to play the angles rather than taking a stand. If Saddam was emboldened by Clinton's refusal to confront force with force, Osama bin Laden was fully energized by it. Had Bill Clinton and Al Gore understood the importance of our national security then, it's quite possible that 9/11 could have been avoided. Yet now, in an effort to rewrite history, to divert attention from their legacy, and score political points along the way, Clinton and Gore have taken to publicly disparaging President Bush's actions. The sheer effrontery of this is overwhelming. For Clinton and Gore to question George Bush's wartime leadership is like Neville Chamberlain second-guessing Winston Churchill during World War II. As we've seen, President Bush's policy toward terrorist states has been decidedly different. In his first State of the Union address, he made clear exactly why it is dangerous to leave rogue nations unchecked in their power. quote, our discoveries in Afghanistan confirmed our worst fears and showed us the true scope of the task ahead, said President Bush. We have seen the depth of our enemies' hatred in videos where they laugh about the loss of innocent life, and the depth of their hatred is equaled by the madness of their destruction they designed. We have found diagrams of American nuclear power plants and public water facilities, detailed instructions for making chemical weapons, surveillance maps of American cities, and thorough descriptions of landmarks in America and throughout the world. Quote, what we have found in Afghanistan confirms that far from ending there, our war against terror is only beginning. Most of the 19 men who hijacked planes on September the 11th were trained in Afghanistan's camps, and so were tens of thousands of others, thousands of dangerous killers schooled in the methods of murder, often supported by outlaw regimes, are now spread throughout the world like ticking time bombs set to go off without warning. President Bush recognized that 9/11 was another act of war, just as Franklin Roosevelt understood the attack on Pearl Harbor to be a date that will live in infamy. In a State of the Union address, President Bush also declared that both the terrorists and the regimes that give them safe harbor would now be the targets of American power. That was a revolution in American policy and a welcome one. For those two groups, terrorists and their rogue sponsors, had lived off each other for much too long, and now we had paid a painful price for their collusion. This was the speech in which President Bush first used the phrase axis of evil, bluntly warning enemies and friends alike of America's unequivocal intention to defeat evil and defend itself. The president singled out three nations that had been terrorizing their own people and their neighbors for as long as most of us could remember. Where others had refused to confront them, now Bush was shining the harsh light of truth on these nations, challenging each of them to change their ways or meet with a day of reckoning. Iraq, lair of a savage mass murderer. North Korea, antagonist to its democratic sister state for half a century. Iran, an outspoken and aggressive supporter of terrorism since the Carter administration allowed the Ayatollah to slip into power. Each of them with ambitions to develop chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, each tolerated for much too long by American presidents, unwilling to challenge them, and by foreign leaders, much too willing to accommodate them. America, at last, had made its position clear. That kind of confidence and bluntness on the world scene, backed up as it was by almost instant action, is a rare thing these days. And it didn't play well around the world, especially from international voices willing to turn a blind eye to evil. The multilateralism lobby was making itself known through the mainstream media, even as the smoke was still rising from ground zero. After a week of unconditional support from abroad, reported the New York Times on September 19, 2001, quote, the Bush administration confronted its first significant difficulties today in building a broad international coalition to support using military power and other means against a still faceless terror network rooted in Afghanistan and elsewhere. A procession of world leaders was either on the way or on the phone to Washington seeking to convince the White House that only a multilateral approach based on consultation, hard evidence, and United Nations support would justify the use of military power in response to the devastating attacks last week. Imagine this, unconditional support for an entire week after the most outrageous terrorist attack in history. Before we could even catch our breath, foreign leaders were already swooping in with quote-unquote conditions for their participation in the new war on terrorism. A multilateral approach based on consultation, hard evidence, and United Nations support? Well, hold it right there, you uncontrollable Americans. Now, one more step. You've got to clear this all with us. Despite these early signals, the Bush administration managed to preserve an international coalition long enough to prevail in Afghanistan. By the following January, though, Bush's identification of the axis of evil brought the appeasers back in force. The French daily newspaper, Le Monde, called Bush's speech alarmist. According to the Sydney Morning Herald, President Bush's worldview was worryingly simplistic and selective. Needless to say, Iran and Iraq were shocked to have made Bush's shortlist. Little Bush's accusation against Iraq is baseless, sneered Salim al-Kwabasi, head of Iraq's Foreign Relations Committee. But such threats do not scare us, as the Iraqi people are well prepared to repel any aggression or foolishness by the American Zionist administration. Iranian President Mohammad Khatami responded in a cabinet session, charging that Bush, quote, spoke arrogantly, humiliatingly, aggressively, and in an interfering way, and worse than anything else, it is an insult to the Iranian nation. As far as Iraq was concerned, President Bush's designation of the Axis of Evil marked the beginning of a deliberate process to increase pressure on Saddam Hussein, a process that would take a whole year to unfold, a process liberal Democrats would later call a rush to war. As the president made clear, time was not on our side. A serious weapons of mass destruction attack on just one major American city could cause a devastating loss of life. And yet, despite all evidence, the buildup to war in Iraq was met by a cacophony of voices committed to undermining President Bush's ability to lead, dividing Americans in their support of the broader war on terror, and creating or supporting an anti-war candidate to challenge the president in 2004. New York Times columnist Anthony Lewis was among the first to use the multilateralist bullhorn in an essay published the very day after the 9/11 attacks, quote, "None of us can pretend to know exactly how to deal with this newly disclosed threat of large-scale sophisticated terrorism," Lewis wrote, "but some basics suggest themselves. Most important, America should reach out to the rest of the world for a united stand against terrorism. Quote, the United Nations must demand that all countries deny shelter to terrorists and help crush them. Governments that reject that demand will be targets for military action. It is essential, too, that our foreign policy from here on forward eschew any impression of unilateralism. Even our allies have seen an administration uninterested in what others think, ready to impose its views. President Bush would do well to adopt a tone of recognizing that America cannot assure security by itself." And so began the refrain heard every day since from the left, damning American self-defense as arrogant unilateralism. Of course, in an era of terrorism, there is an obvious genuine need for global cooperation, but the new appeasers take their vision of engagement far beyond simple cooperation. The new appeasers insist on UN authorization as a precondition to American military action. In other words, they would emasculate the United States and delegate our most vital decisions about self-defense and national security to other nations. This is what the Democrats would have us do, call in the UN, according to the party of Michael Dukakis and George McGovern, consult with France and Germany. Under no circumstances, however, may we act alone. Initially, most Democrats said they supported the president in his prosecution of the war on terror, but their obstructionist behavior belies their words. Sure, they voted for the congressional resolution authorizing military action against Iraq, but now an increasing number of them have declared that they meant only to threaten war or to authorize it only as a last resort, after further inspections had been exhausted. Senator Kerry, apparently anxious to distance himself from his earlier vote in support of the resolution, has claimed that President Bush circumvented the process laid out in the resolution and insisted that the president had promised to work through the United Nations and only go to war as a last resort. General Wesley Clark, a Democratic presidential candidate, said in October 2002 that he supported the resolution. In later interviews, he backtracked, saying he would have supported the resolution for leverage against Iraq, but, quote, "I never would have voted for it for war." When the Democrats aren't worrying about politics, they're worrying about image. For at least a quarter century, they've been fretful that America's strength may be intimidating some in the international sphere. In their desperate attempt to find a hook for their 2004 presidential race, the Democrats are reviving that old European-inflected song, lambasting President Bush as a Texan given a shooting first and asking questions later. Al Gore has been among the most prominent Democrats whistling this tune. In September of 2002, as the buildup to war was underway, Gore blasted his old rival, claiming that the Bush administration had been guilty of a, quote, do-it-alone, cowboy-type reaction to foreign affairs. And even as he admitted that Saddam was a worthy target, he sounded the tinny bell of multilateralism. Quote, "There's ample basis for taking off after Saddam," Gore crowed, "but before you ride out after Jesse James, you ought to put the posse together." The posse? For Gore and the others, that means only one thing, the United Nations. But what exactly does the UN bring to the table in a situation like this? As their track record suggests, not much, besides a wretched legacy of ineffective policies and bungled military operations. And far from being a bastion of democracy that would oppose totalitarianism, the UN often serves as a forum for rogue nations to cloak themselves in an air of legitimacy. Its membership includes an alarming number of tyrants and dictators who could never claim to represent the interests of the people that they rule. This is an organization, after all, whose Human Rights Commission is chaired by Muammar Gaddafi's Libya, one of the world's longest-lived and best-known violators of human rights. In practice, the United Nations has become a kind of organized form of appeasement, anxious to obstruct the actions of law-abiding nations while rewarding rogue nations for their illegal behavior. And the UN has also proven highly ineffective in rebuilding war-torn nations, Kosovo being a case in point. The UN isn't even good at peacekeeping. Rwanda is a prime example. In 1993, it took the UN 5 months to raise a force of fewer than 3,000 troops from the international community to monitor the fighting between warring sides in Rwanda. A transitional government was supposed to have been installed with UN insistence, but faltered. The president of Rwanda, among others, died under suspicious circumstances when his plane crashed while he was returning from peace negotiations with neighboring countries. This ignited an all-out slaughter of the Tutsi minority population by the Hutus' majority, which controlled the military. What did the UN do? Well, you'll never guess. It passed several resolutions to no avail. It opposed an arms embargo on Rwanda and sought to increase its Blue Helmet strength to 5,500 troops. But the member states took 6 full months to volunteer even the small number of troops. And meanwhile, upwards of 800,000 Rwandans were being slaughtered, about 10% of the nation's population. And while this human catastrophe was occurring, well, where was the Clinton administration? Samantha Power, an expert on the genocide in Rwanda, described its negligence. Quote, "In reality, the United States did much more than fail to send troops. It led a successful effort to remove most of the UN peacekeepers who were already in Rwanda. It aggressively worked to block the subsequent authorization of UN reinforcements. It refused to use its technology to jam radio broadcasts that were a crucial instrument in the coordination and perpetuation of the genocide. And even as, on average, 8,000 Rwandans were being butchered every day, the U.S. officials shunned the term genocide for fear of being obliged to act. The United States, in fact, did virtually nothing to try to limit what occurred. Indeed, staying out of Rwanda was an explicit U.S. policy objective." And the same U.S. policymakers, whose hands are dirty from the Rwandan disaster, are now part of the crowd demanding that George W. Bush defer to the U.N. again. President Clinton, Wesley Clark, who advised Clinton against intervention, Madeleine Albright, who was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., with the scar of the Rwandan mass murder on their consciences, it's just hard to imagine how these democratic standard bearers still expect their words to carry any moral authority. So the next time you hear the new appeasers utter the word unilateralist to denounce President Bush and multilateralist to congratulate themselves as foreign policy gurus, think back to George Orwell and his lesson about the uses of language to conceal meaning. The left may insist that their internationalist policy is one of strength and consensus, but in truth, it is one of weakness and paralysis. Ask yourself this. What would have happened if President Bush had listened to the voices of accommodation, hunkered down Clinton style, and waited indefinitely for Saddam to cooperate fully with UN inspections? If the UN had simply refused to enforce its own resolutions as they did throughout the 1990s? At best, Saddam would simply have fooled the inspectors until they returned with some spotty, inconclusive evidence, leaving him to continue his bloodthirsty reign for years to come. And at worst, he would have stepped up his proven campaign to procure WMDs, collude with terrorists, and eventually make good on his threats to dominate the entire Middle East. An unchecked Saddam Hussein in control of 2/3 of the world's oil supply, protected by an arsenal of weapons no one dared provoke him to use? That is what we avoided by going to war when we did. It's an image worth remembering as we choose not only our current political leaders, but those in the future as well. Yes, the United Nations has its place in the world, but every American president must take careful measure of just how much actual responsibility America can share with the UN while still retaining control of America's national security interests. Because of George Bush, Saddam Hussein's evil reign of terror in Iraq has ended. He has been captured and his two evil sons have died a bloody death. While Americans still work to preserve the peace in post-war Iraq for millions of Iraqis, especially the Kurds he tormented for years, George Bush is a hero. They have literally been given their lives back. If Iraq is allowed once again to slip back into darkness, however, the work of thousands of brave American troops will be meaningless. And that's exactly what will happen if the Democrats have their way. In calling for a democratic, Iraqi-led new government in Iraq, President Bush has decided to fight terror not only with force, but also with freedom. The road that lies ahead is difficult. The Middle East does not have an uncheckered record when it comes to creating free societies. But a democratic republic emerging from the ashes of Saddam's dictatorship is the only fair outcome for the people of Iraq. As the 2004 presidential campaign unfolds, the Democrats will pound away at their politically motivated questions. Did we have to go to war? Should we have waited a little while longer? Did the president shade the truth? Have we alienated the French? The American people should ask a very different question. When it comes to protecting American lives and preserving freedom around the world, whom do you trust to get that job done? In March of 2003, only 18 months into the war on terrorism, the mainstream media had already settled back into its old ways. Instead of offering up serious analysis of the progress and future of the war on terror, Newsweek, for one, was backsliding to the same old political war games, diplomacy versus force, moderation versus extremism. I wonder whether the liberal media really believes diplomacy can't turn out to be a trap. Perhaps they've forgotten about Stalin's pact with Hitler or Clinton's arms treaties with North Korea. And do they think that force can always be avoided? That may be the most disturbing thought of all. If one of America's most widely read news magazines is taking the position that military force is never necessary, and this in a time of war, they'd not only lost touch with the American people, they betrayed their fundamental misunderstanding of human nature. The lessons of modern history are clear. Accommodation only leads to escalation. Tyranny cannot be defeated by diplomacy. No brutal dictator will ever be persuaded to give up his dreams of universal power simply because it's the right thing to do. Our leaders, George W. Bush of Midland, Texas, along with Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and the entire Bush administration, recognized that the world is a dangerous place, and they understood exactly how this new kind of war would have to be fought. The Bush administration saw early that we could not repeat the mistake of 9/11. We could no longer wait for the enemy to attack us once again. From this point on, we would have to take the action to the enemy before he had the chance to strike. And we'd have to be willing to strike preemptively, when necessary, at both the terrorists and the nation sponsoring them in order to preserve our national security. President Bush's address at West Point in June of 2002 marked the administration's first reference to the importance of preemptive action in the war on terror. Quote, "The war on terror will not be won on the defensive," said Bush. "We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge. In the world we have entered, the only path to safety is the path of action, and this nation will act." 2 months later, the administration's position was explained further in an address Vice President Cheney gave in Nashville, Tennessee, to the veterans of foreign wars. Cheney strengthened the president's case for preemptive strikes against terrorist targets. Quote, "America and the civilized world have only one option," he said. "Wherever terrorists operate, we must find where they dwell, stop them in their planning, and one by one bring them to justice." But Cheney also announced that America would extend this new doctrine beyond the terrorists themselves to include nations with a proven inclination to sponsor terrorism. It's for that simple reason that the administration took its emphatic position against Saddam Hussein's Iraq and against any other nation that might harbor and support terrorism. The world had waited for a decade for Saddam to comply with the dictates of civilized society, but to no avail. His regime had ignored international pressure, breached United Nations agreements, obstructed weapons inspectors, even endured 4 days of bombing in 1998, and yet it remained as defiant as ever. America could no longer risk the chance that Saddam would take the next logical step in his permanent war on the West. This message was seconded by Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in September of 2002 in a speech to the Metro Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. The conventional weapons of past, Rumsfeld noted, threaten casualties in the hundreds or thousands. Today, said Rumsfeld, quote, the question people are debating is how do you feel about absorbing a blow with weapons of mass destruction? It's not hundreds or thousands of people killed, but it's tens of thousands. With a nation like Iraq, which not only possessed chemical and biological weapons, but had shown a willingness to use them against its own people, the dangers of acting were outweighed by the risk of doing nothing. Rumsfeld and the rest of the Bush administration were careful to point out the clear distinction between a preemptive strike and the act of unprovoked aggression. In a Department of Defense news briefing that same week, Rumsfeld was asked if he saw the war against Iraq as a preemptive war against an imminent threat or a preventive war to keep them from becoming a greater threat. Rumsfeld responded that while preemption involves striking first, it should still be viewed as a defensive action. Everyone agrees that self-defense is legitimate, legal, domestically, internationally, he said. The concept of anticipatory self-defense is also something that goes back historically a long time. Rumsfeld cited President Kennedy's blockade of Cuba during the missile crisis in 1962 as an instance of anticipatory self-defense, remarking that, quote, I think it's not unfair or inaccurate to say that he engaged in preemption. In the weeks and months to follow, the administration continued its case for preparing the United States for the challenges of war in Iraq and beyond. As Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz noted in October 2002, Ronald Reagan's vision of strategic missile defense has become only more relevant in the age of terror, with the nations in Bush's axis of evil developing long-range missile capability and the possibility that terrorists could launch a shorter-range missile from a cargo ship off the coast of the United States. By December 2003, Rumsfeld had declared missile defense, quote, now America's highest priority. Among the threats from terrorists and tyrants, none was more immediate or alarming than that of Saddam Hussein's Iraq. In October 2002, the CIA issued a report labeling Saddam as, quote, intent on acquiring nuclear weapons and projecting that the country probably will have a nuclear weapon during this decade unless preventive action were taken. In the first months after the war, of course, the Democrats had a field day with the lack of immediate hard evidence of Iraq weapons programs. Frankly, I'm mystified that so many seem to take this as evidence that Saddam never had WMDs when the government obviously believes it's just as likely that he might have shipped them off to terrorists or other rogue nations. To my mind, the fact that no weapons have yet been found in Iraq only gives me greater cause for concern. Imagine if you were a warden going to check on Hannibal Lecter in a cell and you found it empty. You wouldn't think, oh, what a relief. Guess we don't have him to worry about anymore, would you? Even in the absence of actual WMDs, though, it's important to know that those combing through the remains of Saddam's regime in Iraq have already turned up incontrovertible evidence of intent. In October 2003, Dr. David Kaye, the chief coalition arms investigator, reported the results of his preliminary inspection to Congress. Here are some of his findings. A clandestine network of laboratories and safe houses within the Iraqi intelligence service that contained equipment subject to UN monitoring and suitable for continuing chemical and biological weapons research. A prison laboratory complex possibly used in human testing of biological weapons agents, which Iraqi officials working to prepare for UN inspections were explicitly ordered not to declare to the UN. Reference strains of biological organisms concealed in a scientist's home, one of which can be used to produce biological weapons. Documents and equipment hidden in scientists' homes that would have been useful in resuming uranium enrichment by centrifuge and electromagnetic isotope separation. Plans and advanced design work for new long-range missiles with ranges up to at least 1,000 kilometers, well beyond the 150-kilometer range limit imposed by the UN. Missiles of 1,000-kilometer range would have allowed Iraq to threaten targets throughout the Middle East, including Ankara, Cairo, and Abu Dhabi. Clandestine attempts between late 1999 and 2002 to obtain from North Korea technology related to 1,300-kilometer range ballistic missiles, 300-kilometer range anti-ship cruise missiles, and other prohibited military equipment. Any way you slice it, it's hard to deny the evidence of Saddam's intent not only to develop prohibited weaponry, but to destroy all traces of any weapons programs. In addition to the discovery of extensive concealment efforts, Dr. Kay told Congress, quote, "We have been faced with a systematic sanitation of documentary and computer evidence in a wide range of offices, laboratories, and companies suspected of WMD work. The pattern of these efforts to erase evidence, hard drives destroyed, specific files burned, equipment cleaned of all traces of use, are ones of deliberate rather than random acts." The Democrats have droned on about the question of capability since before the invasion of Iraq. But as the administration has made clear, in the face of overwhelming proof of intent, it would have been foolhardy and dangerous to hold our fire until the Democrats could be satisfied with our evidence of capability. Saddam was working feverishly to produce WMDs, just as he had been for more than a decade preceding our attack, and just as feverishly covering up his activities. If we had waited until he had achieved full capability, it could have been too late. It's not as though this news should have come as much of a surprise. After all, Bill Clinton made the same case in 1998 that President Bush has made in 2002 and 2003. In announcing the military strikes against Saddam in 1998, Clinton told the nation that his goal was to, quote, attack Iraq's nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs and its military capacity to threaten its neighbors. As Clinton pointed out, Iraq wasn't the only country to have developed WMDs, but with Saddam, there's one big difference. He has used them not once, but repeatedly, unleashing chemical weapons against Iranian troops during a decade-long war, and not only against soldiers, but against civilians. Firing Scud missiles at the citizens of Israel, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and Iran, and not only against a foreign enemy, but even against his own people, gassing Kurdish civilians in northern Iraq. The international community had little doubt then, and I have no doubt today, left unchecked, Saddam Hussein will use these terrible weapons again. Faced with the threat from Iraq, even Bill Clinton acknowledged the importance of preemption. Heavy as they are, the cost of action must be weighed against the price of inaction. If Saddam defies the world and we fail to respond, we will face a far greater threat in the future. Saddam will strike again at his neighbors. He will make war on his own people, and mark my words, he will develop weapons of mass destruction. He will deploy them, and he will use them. As usual, Clinton talked a better game than he played. The handful of missiles he fired had no lasting effect on Saddam. Apparently, his words also failed to make much of an impression among members of his own party. Just a few years later, they seemed to have no recollection that Iraq had ever possessed weapons of mass destruction. The missing WMD uproar after the Iraq War was so politically useful to the Democrats that they all caught a bad case of Iraqi amnesia. And one thing the American left wing never forgets, though, is how to scare up a hysterical protest movement. Having invented the art form with Vietnam, then kept it up with the nuclear freeze movement in the Reagan era, and briefly Al Gore's Florida recount debacle in 2000, they've now returned to form as the party of the anti-war lunatic fringe. Starting in the months before Operation Enduring Freedom began, the anti-war cabal has made its shrill voice heard throughout the land for the last year or so. And you can bet they'll still be crowing when election time rolls around in November. Today's anti-war movement is just as strident as the nuclear freeze movement during the 80s, with the same streak of mindless pacifism. But the modern anti-war movement is broad-based, including the liberal media, intellectual and academic elites, the Hollywood left, and many of the extremists in Congress and on the presidential campaign trail. I go out of my way to debate with members of the anti-war crowd whenever I can, whether on Hannity and Combs or on my radio show. I often make a point of saying that I don't like the expression anti-war because it suggests that all the rest of us are pro-war. And the truth is, I don't know any sensible person who is pro-war, but most of the smart people I know are realists, and we realize that war will be a reality in this world as long as evil and tyranny conspire to terrorize human beings and stand in the way of freedom. But most peace activists I've talked to seem oblivious to the dangers in the world. They're contemptuous of anyone with a realistic outlook. The rhetoric of the protesters has gotten so outrageous that you really wonder whether they've taken leave of their senses. One of their favorite tricks was to claim that the Bush administration was no more moral than Saddam Hussein's regime. In March of 2003, as our troops were preparing to enter harm's way in Iraq, James Carroll of the Boston Globe published an essay entitled America the Destroyer, comparing our military campaign to the 9/11 atrocity. Carroll asked, quote, "And what exactly would justify such destruction? What would make it an act of virtue? And in what way would such decapitation spark in the American people anything but a horror to make memories of 9/11 seem a pleasant dream?" Carroll went as far as to equate our actions with those of the terrorists. Quote, "If our nation, in other words, were on its receiving end, illusions would lift and we would see shock and awe for exactly what it is, terrorism, pure and simple." Perhaps the most notorious of the apologists for Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, though, is MIT professor Noam Chomsky. On October the 18th, 2001, little more than a month after 9/11, Chomsky gave a bizarre lecture in which, according to a campus news outlet, he bore down on the propagandist militarist leaning in the U.S. media and what he described as the history of American terrorism in Nicaragua, Chile, Costa Rica, Honduras, Argentina, Colombia, and Turkey, not to mention Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Chomsky also made the claim that terror, as defined by the U.S. Army manuals, is the driving force of American foreign policy. Here at home, terrorism is seen as what people who are against us do. When America perpetrates violence, it is renamed counterinsurgency or counterterror, terms coined by various U.S. administrations to rationalize its actions. The ranks of anti-war protesters swelled in the months before the war. On January 18, 2003, hundreds of thousands of them marched in Washington, D.C. to condemn the Bush administration for, quote, "rushing into war," a war they insisted would kill thousands of Iraqi civilians and set a dangerous precedent for preemptive military strikes. It was said to be the largest anti-war rally since the Vietnam era. On that same day, thousands of other protesters assembled in San Francisco and Tampa. The organizers chose that date because the UN weapons inspector's first major report was due January 27, 2003. Quote, "The anti-war movement is now at a whole new level," said Tony Murphy, a spokesman for International Answer, an anti-war organization formed just 3 days after the September 11, 2001 attacks, apparently ready to protest any American response before they could even know what it might be. By now, the protesters had dug out their old No War for Oil banners, accusing the Bush administration of attacking Iraq to exploit its oil. One protester charged that the war, quote, "is more about oil than terrorism." After this war in Afghanistan, it seemed like Bush just wants to keep going, other marchers yelled. "We don't want your oil war." Another group called Truth, Peace, Justice was organized by an anti-American ex-Marine known variously as Ken Nichols O'Keefe and Kenneth Roy Nichols. O'Keefe Nichols had renounced his U.S. citizenship in 2002, declaring the United States the number one terrorist on the planet with the political goal of total global domination. In organizing Truth, Justice, Peace, he included a manifesto declaring that as thinking people, we see the obvious that George W. Bush is far more of a threat to world peace than Saddam Hussein. O'Keefe's group attracted an array of protesters whose motivations range from the malicious to the naive. Some of these protesters not only held America in contempt, but eagerly sang Iraq's praises. David Hilfiker, a doctor, said, "What the American people are not aware of is that before sanctions, Iraq was highly successful. It had free health care, education was universally available. They had reduced the infant mortality rate." In February 2003, anti-war protesters staged a rally in New York City. The result was so pleasing to Saddam that he showed the footage on a state-run television network over the logo, quote, "International Day of Confronting the Aggression." On its website, the week before the rally, Answer advertised a number of workshops it would be conducting on February 14, 2003, as part of a teach-in and rally in New York City. The website featured the agenda for the workshops and stated its purpose: building an anti-war movement that connects the struggle against the war on Iraq with the fight for social and economic justice and civil rights at home. Among the topics to be covered at the workshop were the historical background of U.S. imperialism in the Middle East. The threatened U.S. war against Iraq must be understood as a continuation of the exploitive, militarist, and colonial policy of Western superpowers that they've followed in the region for the last century. The way in which the evolving needs of U.S. imperialism affected its relationship to Iraq, as well as how world events impacted on Iraq's development. The long history of U.S. government in regime change, including many instances of overthrowing democratically elected governments. The cost of war at home, money for social programs, not for war. In order to support a new war on the occupation of Iraq, funds will be diverted from domestic programs for additional military spending following a pattern of a society that would rather produce missiles than provide health care because it makes for greater profits. Hollywood also contributed its usual share of left-wing agitation against the war. President Martin Sheen, star of NBC's The West Wing, accused the president of starting the war as a personal vendetta. Quote, I think he'd like to hand his father Saddam Hussein's head and win his approval for what happened after the Gulf War. Comedian Janine Garofalo has claimed that there's nothing you could point to in the Bush administration with pride. Nothing. There is no way any rational, reasonable person can say that the Bush administration has been good for America, and in a statement that betrayed either profound ignorance or irresponsible indifference to the evils of Saddam's regime, Richard Gere claimed that, quote, there doesn't seem to be any indications whatsoever that this man poses an immediate threat to anybody. Soon the anti-war fever had spread to the houses of Congress, where Democratic leaders, who might have preferred to accommodate Saddam, grappled over how to vote on a war that was widely popular with the American people. Our good friend Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts told an anti-war rally that, quote, the administration's doctrine is a call for 21st century American imperialism that no other nation can or should accept. Naked aggression is not the American way, complained Marcy Kaptur, a congressional Democrat from Ohio. Kaptur was later quoted as likening Osama bin Laden to the American founding fathers. And Dennis Kucinich, Kaptur's fellow Ohio Democrat and a 2004 presidential candidate, claimed that, quote, this attempt to foment war is really against the best interest of America. It is against the spirit of the country. It is against the economic interests of the people. However, many of their Democratic colleagues were anything but supportive of the war effort, as we've shown in some detail. The Democratic Party has become hostage to the extreme left wing. But gratifyingly, a few Democrats, not enough in my opinion, came forward to speak out against the leftward surge of their party. I was pleasantly surprised when Andrew Cuomo, a liberal Democrat, also sternly rebuked his party. Cuomo, a Clinton administration cabinet secretary, charged today's crop of Democrats with being lost in time, often appearing bloodless, soulless, and clueless, and fumbling their role in the post-9/11 world. In contrast, Cuomo praised President Bush for recognizing the challenge of 9/11 and rising to it. The president had provided true leadership, Cuomo said, and he and other Republicans deserve credit for understanding and rising to 9/11. We Democrats handled 9/11 like it was a debate over a highway bill instead of a matter of people's lives. Sadly, Cuomo, along with former Congressman and New York Mayor Ed Koch, were rare sober voices in a party that has been hijacked by the radical left. But at least one very other important voice has emerged from the Democratic Party. Senator Zell Miller, who has taken his colleagues to task in his recent book, A National Party No More, Miller pledged President Bush's full support in co-sponsoring the Iraq War resolution. At present, two distinct visions for America's security are battling for supremacy within American society, that of President Bush and that of the Democratic Party, including all nine of its presidential candidates and its other potential contenders, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton. The Bush administration's assessment of the challenges we face from terrorists and their state sponsors is serious, thoughtful, and it's realistic. The anti-war activists of the Democratic left, on the other hand, have expressed a vision that is naive at best, dangerously out of touch at worst. The American people have demonstrated in poll after poll that they trust President Bush to lead us through this perilous time. Appeasement-minded, democratic, and misguided celebrities may have been able to use the media to gain some attention for their side, but relatively few Americans share their radical worldview. And that's why this crowd has been pulling out all the stops to undermine President Bush's credibility since talk of war with Iraq began, and why they can be counted on to keep it up as this election cycle plays itself out. With their talk of American terrorism and war for oil, the Democrats may think they can draw blood in their current cutthroat political battle, but the American people are smart enough to see through their rhetoric. And when the dust settles after the election, the Democratic anti-war lobby may wake up and realize that the blood they were smelling was on their own hands. Since the early 1990s, Bill and Hillary Clinton have enjoyed virtually total control over the Democratic Party. Bill Clinton was the first Democrat since FDR to serve two consecutive full four-year terms as president. Hillary Clinton was the first lady to be elected to the United States Senate. The Democratic National Committee, the DNC, is filled with Clinton loyalists, current DNC Chair Terry McAuliffe chief among them. Dick Morris, who has advised the Clintons closely, says that they use the DNC as their private fund, channeling donations to candidates and causes they favor or that favor them. In addition to their control of the party levers, Bill Clinton insists on maintaining a visible presence on the political stage. He seems to have an insatiable appetite for control and attention, never missing an opportunity to share his policy views or attack the current administration in public speeches. He even injects himself into the role of senior advisor to a number of the Democratic presidential contenders and strategizes with party leaders, partly perhaps to satisfy his ego and partly to ensure that he retains ties to whatever candidate becomes the eventual nominee. Many political insiders, of course, believe that as soon as it appears politically feasible, the Clintons will attempt to seize power once again in the form of a Hillary Clinton presidency. Whenever that should occur, it seems likely that the Clintons will play a significant role and have considerable influence over Democratic policy, including their attitude toward national security for years to come, all of which should be a matter of grave concern for Americans who understand the importance of vigilance in the face of evil. The reasons for apprehension are clear. The events of the Clinton presidency contributed to many of the international problems we now face. And yet the Clintons have managed to elude any real accountability for their actions while retaining a serious base of support among Democratic voters. Consider this. In December 2003, a poll cited on NBC's Meet the Press showed Howard Dean with 20% support among likely voters, Wesley Clark with 15%, Dick Gephardt 15%, John Kerry 14%, and Joe Lieberman with 9%. When a pollster placed Hillary Clinton's name in the mix, however, Mrs. Clinton had 43% support against Dean's 12% and Clark's 10%. Like it or not, the Clintons are the heart and soul of today's and tomorrow's Democratic Party. Though Mrs. Clinton has consistently denied that she is running for president this year, it clearly appears that she is setting herself up for a run in 2008. Most analysts, myself included, believe that Mrs. Clinton stands a better chance at being elected president when she will not have to face an incumbent. At the time of this writing, Saddam Hussein has been captured. The military battles in Afghanistan and Iraq have been won. Despite continuing skirmishes on the ground in Iraq, there has not been another major terrorist attack on U.S. soil, and the U.S. economy is on the rebound. President Bush will be difficult to defeat in the 2004 election. Mrs. Clinton is a smart enough politician to recognize this. Barring some last-minute convention upheaval, she's not likely to run for president this time. During the 2004 presidential election, then, the Clintons may cede center stage to the Democratic nominee, but make no mistake, if that nominee fails to win the presidency, the Clintons will reassume their position as the face of the Democratic Party. What makes Hillary a formidable contender is that she is the one Democrat with the political skills to bridge the current gap between the moderate wing of the Democratic Party and the radical base that is necessary to secure any nomination. She's working to build a record as a moderate hawk by questioning President Bush's policies in the war on terror, but she may also be the one Democrat who can talk tough on Iraq and still command the support of the party's left wing. This makes Hillary especially dangerous from a political standpoint. But if their presidency taught us anything, it's that the Clintons' political positions are just that. They're purely political. They're a form of camouflage created to help the candidate appeal to a broad base of moderate votes while concealing their true far-left colors. The record is clear. The Clintons have failed in the past to confront evil, and if given another chance, they'll fail again. We cannot afford the danger they pose to our nation's security. As journalists like Rich Lowry and Richard Miniter have made clear with the events of September 11th, it became clear that the Clinton administration's most damaging legacy had nothing to do with his personal moral recklessness. It concerned his utter failure to safeguard the national security interests of the United States by refusing to confront evil with strength and resolve. Today, Bill Clinton may pine over his lost opportunity to shine in foreign policy, but he conveniently overlooks the many chances he had to engage the terrorists. If Clinton had had the courage to recognize and act upon them, he could have seized any number of legitimate opportunities to commence the war on terrorism that America was destined to face. Consider the record of terrorist attacks on America during Clinton's time in office. Osama bin Laden's attack against American Marines in Yemen in 1992, the first bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, the Khobar Towers incident in 1996, the bombing of American embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, the bombing of the USS Cole in 2000. Each of these took place on Clinton's watch, yet the Clinton administration largely relegated terrorism to the back burner. In the words of former CIA agent and State Department member Larry Johnson, quote, the Clinton administration paid lip service to the notion of combating terrorism through some money added, but generally kept it at a very low priority. When it came to pursuing bin Laden after the Yemen attack, Clinton seemed wholly uninterested. In losing bin Laden, his history of Clinton's record on terror, Richard Miniature notes that Yemen wanted help tracking down Osama bin Laden, but no help ever came. Clinton was all talk and no action. After promising that he had, quote, put the full resources of the federal government to work on the problem of terrorism, he made no changes in American policy to prevent future attacks. The goal of the bombers in the 1993 World Trade Center attack was to topple one of the towers onto the other amid a cloud of cyanide gas. It was later discovered that Ramzi Youssef, the terrorist who executed the 1993 attack, was also plotting to bomb 11 U.S. commercial aircraft in one spectacular day of terrorist rage. Youssef attempted to engineer the bombs to be made of liquid explosive designed to pass through air.